Welcome to the final season team preview episode of the Three Bid League podcast. As always, I'm Tyler, joined by my co-host Matt, and we will be covering the favorites group this week: Dayton, VCU, Duquesne, and St. Bonaventure. A reminder to everyone who is just hopping into this episode now, be sure to go back over these last 3 weeks. We put together episodes for all of the other A-10 teams, separated into the dark horse contenders, the wild cards, and the rebuilding teams. Matt, I feel like people are going to be insulted by our use of the word favorite here, because this is looking like it's going to be a wide open A-10. And I also just think that the fans of the other fan bases are insulted by the idea that Dayton and VCU are just going to be better than them this year.
I'd agree with you. It's a wide open league, although, you know, we came up with these groups several weeks ago, and this one ended up lining up perfectly with the A-10 media poll, where we ended up with the four teams picked there on media day a couple weeks ago. So I still wouldn't take these too seriously. I mean, some of the other teams that we've talked about the last couple weeks, which you should all go back and listen to if you haven't yet, I mean, plenty of them could win the league too, but I think what these teams have in common, with maybe the exception of Duquesne, but they still saw such a great upward trajectory. These are four teams that we are used to seeing have success in the A-10, teams that have shown improvement year over year at times. And other than VCU, which is kind of a very unique situation that we've never really seen for a favorite in the league, they're all bringing back a lot of key pieces.
Yeah, and I think Dayton's really the most interesting case here. People talk about how ravaged they were by injuries, and they were, but people seem to have kind of forgotten that Tumani Kamara was such an important part to this team, and he's now gone. So a lot of wild card pieces, and we'll get into it here in a moment, but so many interesting new guys and the return of all of those injured guards to, fingers crossed, what we believe right now is full health. It makes it a much less certain first place prediction than you'd normally have when you have a possible All-American anchoring your roster.
Although I think it's okay that it's almost refreshing that we don't have a slam dunk first place pick. I mean, I really think for maybe you'd have to go back to the first year we did the podcast when St. Louis was kind of picked first by default, but really that just wasn't a good year for the conference in general. And kind of similar to this one where it was wide open. But yeah, I mean, we still haven't seen the number one preseason team win the regular season since, I think, 2018 Rhode Island. And this year, you know, Dayton maybe got cursed again, although I was expecting them to get picked first on media day, but I wasn't as confident as I have been in prior years. Normally, it's just pretty obvious, you know, who it's going to be based on the media hype and teams that are getting written about over the offseason.
I would have been very surprised just because of the narrative that started to take hold, that I think people who just didn't watch this team looked at the games played for Smith and Elvis and Brea and just chalked it up to, oh, well, they didn't have their guards. Like, we could go pick and choose four losses where that really mattered. Like, if they had Malachi, they would have beaten UNLV. But there were some shaky performances in between when they did have their full roster. And so, yeah, it's not a runaway first-place team by any stretch of the imagination. And we'll see next week when we do our predictions if we both have them first. I get the feeling we both won't. At least one of us might, but I get the feeling we're not going to both put them up there.
To be honest, I haven't even... There's a lot of teams just in general, like Dayton being one of them, where I haven't figured out what I want to do for predictions. Part of that is we're still waiting on like transfer stuff to get sorted out for a few teams and eligibility rules. I mean, guys have gotten injured, unfortunately, in the last couple weeks of practice and could miss some time. So things are still moving around quite a bit in the A10. And yeah, I mean, it should be fun as we continue to discuss. There are a lot of contenders, a lot of teams that could make noise, and overall, just a lot of new faces across the league as we see in the NIL and transfer portal era.
Yeah, so for anyone who's unfamiliar by this point, we will give each team about 10 minutes each, set the timer there. We'll go over the returning players because at this point, everyone, although save for St. Bonaventure, who lost basically no one of note, but most teams tend to lose more players than they keep at this point. We'll go over some of our biggest questions for the season, X factors, and then what we believe their fan base's expectations will be for the year. And just trying to guess on that, if you're a fan of one of these teams and you feel like we hit it on the nose or we were dead wrong, reach out to us on Twitter at the 3BidLeaguePod. Our DMs are always open. But without further ado, let's kick it off with those preseason favorites, the Dayton Flyers. I've mentioned most of the names coming back. It's that backcourt trio, Malachi Smith, Kobe Elvis should start again. Kobe Bray is the sixth man. And then the superstar in the middle, the best player in the Atlantic 10, Daron Holmes, coming back for, let's be honest, probably one last ride here. Because if he has a great season, the NBA is going to come calling.
Yeah, and I really think, Dayton should want him to be ready for the NBA. And I feel like we kind of said the same thing last year, where if Holmes was ready to declare for the draft, that probably meant that Dayton had a really good season. Unfortunately, it didn't really work out that way. And I wouldn't say that had to do with Duran. He was incredible as a sophomore, and that's part of why it was a pleasant surprise that he returned to the A-10 and returned to Dayton. And I really don't think in the A-10, I mean, even Obi Toppin and like Bones Highland going into the preseason, have we seen a player out of this conference get so much All-American buzz in several years?
No, I can't think of one off the top of my head. I mean, this is certainly more buzz than Obi had going into his breakout season. He was a lot more similar to where Duran was last year, where there was a fair amount of momentum for A10 player of the year, but even that wasn't anywhere close to a certainty. I know I probably jumped the gun a little bit picking Duran to be an All-American last season. So it's not going to be spicy when I inevitably do the same this year. But he is. He's probably the most hyped player coming back since, well, even EC Matthews got hurt right when he was supposed to come into his big final season. So DeAndre Bembry?
That's probably about it. Yeah, it's been a while. I've been trying to think of it as we've gone through this. Or like Trevion Graham, maybe. I mean, VCU had some good guys back then, but yeah, it's tough to think about. But I think one of the interesting storylines with Dayton this year, and I don't think we need to spend too much time talking about why Daron Holmes is great. We've done that a lot before. We're going to keep doing it throughout the season. But I think part of what made him a special player is that front court tandem of him and Tumani Kamara. Dayton's going to have to replace a ton of rebounding production. And really, there's out of the new options to fill that spot alongside Holmes, it's guys that don't have a ton of minutes of college experience. Zimi Wokeji's the one returning guy that could fill that role. But in terms of transfers, it's probably looking like Nate Santos out of Pitt, who at 6'7" only averaged about 7 minutes a game last year on a team that ended up making the tournament, but can stretch the floor a little bit, had some decent rebounding numbers. Seems like he is going to be in line for a much bigger role than he's had the last couple of years with the Panthers.
Without a question, without a doubt, the biggest question to me with this team is can they get good rebounding production from those forwards? They actually finished +5 per game in rebounding margin last year, which to the eye test seems completely impossible because when Tumani Kamara came off the court, they got pummeled on the boards. And it was blatantly obvious to anyone watching. The reason that they were so good is because they had two great offensive rebounders on the floor together a ton in Holmes and Kamara. Daron Holmes is probably his biggest deficiency as a player. He is a weaker defensive rebounder than you would think. And they only held up on that end because Kamara was one of the best in the country at that and was just an absolute beast on the glass, a guy that is completely irreplaceable from in that regard. They're going to need a lot of help there throughout. And they played an exhibition with Ohio State last weekend, and it was actually a little bit encouraging. A lot of their young guys, Santos, the backup center, Isaac Jack, Petrus Podejimus, they were hitting the offensive boards hard and getting hands on balls. And maybe this turns into a little bit closer of last year's team, a really good offensive rebounding team that's just okay on the defensive end. That might be enough, but yeah, a lot of it falls on Nate Santos, like you said.
And I think just in general, too, it'll be interesting to see how Dayton adjusts to playing. I think they're going to have to play smaller last year because don't forget Kamara, but they also lose 6'10" Mustafa Amzil. And I mean, Santos and Wokeji, both smaller than those guys. Petra's 6'8", but he's just a true freshman. So hard to know how much he'll play right away, although he was solid in the Ohio State game. But kind of seems like we could see Dayton go a little bit more guard heavy. And last year, they really couldn't afford to do that just because of health. And at times, they only had one or two guards on the court. I feel like we're going to see a lot more quickness out there along the perimeter.
The only thing that I take issue with what you just said, losing 6'10" Mustafa Amzil doesn't really make them smaller. Like, we can say the same about how they lost 6'9" Mark Sharavjoms. Neither of them played to their size. Even though Amzil was actually a power forward, he was pretty disappointing in the rebounding department. I feel like Anthony Grant did a great job of kind of plugging the holes this offseason, of finding guys who actually would have made a lot of sense on last year's roster. It's those rebounders that he has now. I think Santos is actually going to be a big help in that department to kind of put a bow on that. But the biggest one is Enoch Cheeks coming in from Robert Morris, an all-conference guy in the Horizon League. He's essentially the offensive version of Kobe Elvis, the way that he played there. A guy who can hit from deep, give you some slashing to the rim, and also some provide some solid defense on bigger wings. Kind of gives you what they had hoped for from Elvis last year. And now with those two guys playing together, if those are your starting wings, it's a little bit on the smaller end. But you got two guys who are going to be really versatile in their ability to kind of swap their roles game in and game out and possession by possession. You could drop a lot of different plays with those two guys. And the most promising thing from that exhibition that we should mention, Enoch Cheeks caught hellfire from deep in that game. Five threes in the first half. He looked incredibly comfortable in that offense. And it's a beautiful shot.
Yeah, I mean, I think with Cheeks too, the encouraging thing is that he was the leader at Robert Morrison in usage rate for the team. And I don't really think, just with how much Dayton's run through the front court the last two seasons, they've never really had to rely on a ton of scoring from the guards. And like Malachi Smith isn't really a guy who looks to score. Kobe Elvis, Dayton just hasn't really had a ton of efficiency out of him when he becomes a high usage gunner. And then Kobe Graham, more of just a 3-point specialist still. So I think having Cheeks, having that versatile 3-level scorer is going to be huge. And I don't think Dayton is going to rely on him as much as Robert Morris did, just because Cheeks is going to have some more talent around him. But it does give Dayton that option where I would kind of expect at this point he would be the second leading scorer on the team, but behind Holmes.
You can take a big question out of that, though. And when you talk about Cheeks taking on a smaller role, he certainly will throughout the duration of the game. But one of my big questions for this team, who is the guy? And this is a very different question than when we ask it in the context of, say, like Rhode Island, where we're looking to see, is there someone on that roster who can be an all-conference player who can pull them out of the basement? Dayton has two all-conference dudes already. Daron Holmes, Malachi Smith, if they play up to what they should, they will be honored at the end of the year. But very similar to those Richmond teams of the endless seniors, we're talking young Tyler Burton before Blake Francis left, where their best players were clearly Golden Gilliard and at that time Nick Sherrod, none of whom were like a go-to crunch time scorer in the way that Malachi Smith and Daron Holmes have never proven to be. And it was something that really killed them in a few games last year. I think about like the VCU game that they blew, the George Mason game. They don't have a guy who can create their own shot. Kamara did it a little bit, but I just don't think Malachi Smith ever has the mindset to do that. He's looking for the open shooter in those moments. And someone, it's basically probably got to be either Enoch Cheeks or maybe Kobe Brea, has to take on that responsibility of being the guy who's going to get you the bucket when the game is at its toughest point.
Yeah, it's been Kobe Elvis a couple times here and there, but I mean, none of
it
Dayton's
can be if we
guys,
see 2 years ago Kobe Elvis.
But none of them have consistently done that. And I agree with you. That's what cost them a couple games last year and just felt like it was hard for them to call back when they were behind late in the second half. It wasn't really a team that would go on big scoring runs, but they would just win games on defense and kind of wear you out, get a ton of defensive rebounds and hold teams to a low percentage. And this year, it feels like with the lack of size and losing a couple key defensive pieces, it might be a little bit tougher to win those type of just slug it out 61 possession games.
Yeah, and the good thing for them is they just have more shot creators and shot makers this year. Kobe Brea is no longer alone in that department. Felt like they just had to rely on him for those mid-game scoring sparks far too often. They have Cheeks now. I think one of the guys who could sneakily be in that department, Petros Padažymas, the freshman from Lithuania who we talked about in the rebounding department, but he's a guy who stats-wise has shown a pretty diverse offensive arsenal and a play that's just going to stick in my head from that exhibition for weeks until we see for sure whether or not he can do this. He had a really nice pull-up jumper at the foul line. And I don't think I've seen a Dayton Flyer take one of those whose name wasn't Kobe Brea in like 4 years.
I do want to touch a little bit on what the guard transfers mean for the team's defense, because as we've talked about, rebounding could quite possibly take a hit, but really the other weakness for Dayton's defense last year, and I wouldn't even really call it a weakness as much of just a decision, but they were very patient, sat back, did not put a whole lot of pressure on the ball and force really any turnovers.
Yeah, and they were getting killed by opposing teams' best guards game in, game out.
Well, that would happen on the days where they would get hot and they, you know, didn't hold teams to a low percentage, but with Cheeks, top 10 in the Horizon League in both steals and block rate last year. They also get Javon Bennett, who is the reigning rookie of the year in the NEC, coming from Merrimack, second in the nation in steal rate. All of a sudden, you add Bennett and Cheeks. I feel like that's going to give Dayton so much more quickness, where they might be able to get out in transition more, forcing turnovers. That's just something they couldn't really do last year, especially with the guards being banged up, not as quick as they were 2 years ago. I think just between the personnel and also having more depth, it might allow a little bit of a different defensive philosophy for the Flyers.
Yeah, and to wrap that up, my X factor for the team, the one key piece to that you didn't mention, Kobe Elvis, who at this point, I'm just going to assume was hurt the second half of last year. We know he got dinged up. He took a step down last season. If he can get back to the guy he was, someone that you can throw on the other team's best player and let a guy like Enoch Cheeks kind of play a little bit more free safety, try to jump in for those steals and blocks while also giving you some, while Elvis also gives you just some decent production on the offensive end. It's less of a mandate now with Cheeks next to him, but they need him back to starter level. And I think him and Cheeks together can be a really special pairing, just given the way that their skill sets match. But we got to see the Kobe Hilvis of old this year. Hopefully he's healthy. Hopefully he can put last season in the rearview mirror. As you talk about it, I'm thinking about, oh, Malachi Smith goes to the bench. You throw out a defensive lineup of Bennett, Elvis, Cheeks, Holmes, and whoever your power forward is. It's going to be tough as hell to score against that five.
All right. I feel like this is probably the easiest one out of the 15 teams, but is there anything else on Dayton, or are you ready to get into the expectation segment?
Yeah, make the tournament. You talk about all they've been robbed by, whether it was terrible luck with COVID or terrible luck with some massively underseeded 10 seeds. Dayton hasn't given their fans a fun NCAA tournament game since 2015. They need one this year. Because whether, and I, we'll talk, I'm sure we'll have, I'm sure people will want us to talk about it 80 times during the season. I have no idea what actually makes Anthony Grant's seat hot. But I can tell you what, if he misses the tournament again this year, the fans are going to be ready to just throw him out of that arena.
I mean, you say have a fun NCAA tournament game. If we get an 11 seed and get blown out, I think I'd take that at this point. Like, just get there, whether it's an at-large or winning the A-10 tournament. I think it's that simple for Dayton. It's, you know, due to unfortunate circumstances, it has been 6 seasons now without getting to play in the big dance. And I don't know if it's a... I mean, it's very uncertain whether this year's team is better than what Dayton's put on the court the last 2 years for teams that couldn't get it done. But as we continue to say, the league is there for the taking and it's wide open. And there's no reason with the talent they have that they shouldn't at least be in the strong conversation to win in Brooklyn in March.
Yeah, and this is probably the deepest team that they've had in a while. They don't quite have the star-level talent without Tumani Kamara there anymore. But they just have a lot more optionality that they've had in years past, and maybe that's the difference this time around. The lack of depth killed them last year. It was a big problem. It was why a lot of those guards had to keep playing hurt.
Yeah, and not to make excuses too, and we can wrap it up on this, but I think it is worth noting all three of Dayton's returning guards had off-season surgeries. And I know I complained at the time, too. I'm like, why are they opting out of the NIT? That would be good experience. I mean, they were really running on empty at the end of last season. And I do think that is impressive that they made it to the A-10 final. And, I mean, at halftime, had a good chance to win. So, yeah, I mean, hopefully they get a little bit better fortune this year and guys can stay on the court and play to the best of their abilities. Because, man, I mean... just as a fan, I have to say it would be a huge shame to not see Daron Holmes in the tournament, because this is probably the last shot you have with him.
I would think so myself. It's do or die for this date, for this group of Dayton players. So we're moving on to the team that did win the A-10 title last year. That is the VCU Rams. And if you're looking for guys who contributed in that game to put on that black and gold jersey again, you'll find Zeb Jackson. And that's it. Brand new team for VCU. Mike Rhodes obviously going to Penn State. They bring in the Utah State coach, Ryan Odom, bringing him back to the region where his dad put together a great coaching career. He's back on the Atlantic coast. And most notably, he brings with him two starters from last year's Utah State team that made the NCAA tournament, combo guard Max Shulga, and the big playmaking four, Cameron Bairstow. Although, quick asterisk, it looks like Bairstow's out through at least November, possibly deeper into the non-conference. A huge blow for VCU that we just learned about.
Yeah, and this is really one of the most interesting favorites we've ever had since having this podcast about the A-10. Like you said, VCU bringing back one player out of the rotation, losing their coach. Although I wanted to look this up and didn't have time. I'd be really curious to see the last time an Atlantic 10 school made a coaching hire of somebody that got an at-large bid the prior season. I mean, I think that's one place we just need to start. Ryan Odom was a pretty tremendous hire. I feel like immediately you would expect him to be one of the best coaches in the A-10, and that's not something that often happens when someone leaves for greener pastures.
Yeah, and all the great coaches that came in last year, where we could have said the same thing, but Frank Martin was coming off of probably the roughest patch of his career. Same with Archie Miller. Ryan Odom had an awesome team last season and nearly made the tournament 2 years ago as well. Like, this is a guy who is still rising and is coming off of what was, let's be completely honest. In terms of coaching acumen, this is the high point of his career so far, even if it might not be emotionally. And for those who don't remember, he coached UMBC to the 16-1 upset over Virginia.
And I think one of the, key things to think about too with him coming to VCU, I feel like he wouldn't leave a good situation at Utah State coming off such a great season. I mean, he didn't take what some people might call a lateral move, maybe a slight step up to VCU, but he wouldn't make that move if he didn't think he could win a lot of big games. And I think that starts with the two Utah State acquisitions, Shulga and Bairstow. Just having some form of continuity from a group that had a ton of success last year, I think is going to be the key. But I feel like just in general, like we talked about this a ton with St. Bonaventure last year, how they were bringing back almost nothing. VCU's in a little bit of a different situation where at least they have one rotation player and a couple freshmen who were sparingly used last year, but how much do you think Shulga and Bairstow, at least initially, can kind of keep that continuity with Odom's coaching philosophies, pretty much bringing together a new team? I mean, we could have had VCU easily if we wanted to, if we wanted to have some fun with people. We could have thrown them in the group of completely new rosters that we had a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, I think it's huge to have what were probably the third and fourth best players on that team last year come with you to kind of guide their teammates into it. I think that this was something that might have been an issue with Frank Martin last season at UMass, that his system is so different from what they were playing under Matt McCall, that it certainly helps to have dudes who were key pieces of it to essentially be your coaches on the floor. And especially when it's your, and I'm going to air quote point guard on Max Shulga, because apparently it sounds like he is not going to take on the primary of that role, although I expect playmaking to be a critical piece of his arsenal. But he's the leader on the floor for this team, and he gets to be that extension of what Ryan Odom is over on the bench.
One, I think part of that too, in Utah State in general last year, one of the highest assist rates in the country. I think we can very much expect the Rams to do a great job sharing the basketball, but Shulga put up really good assist numbers despite not being the primary point guard for the Aggies last year. And if it's not him, it seems like a lot of those minutes would go to Jason Nelson transferring from Richmond, not making much of a big move at all and staying in the Atlantic 10, who we saw have some up and down moments last year as a redshirt freshman. I think he got off to a tremendous start to the season, was had a couple big scoring games, and then kind of found himself out of the starting lineup for a while during conference play. But I think his familiarity with the conference, having a season under his belt, getting a lot of minutes at the point guard, I feel like that should pay a lot of dividends, and seems like he will have, at least unless they go to Shulga, he'll have another crack at a starting rotation spot.
So this is one of my big questions surrounding the team. Do they have the proper playmaking to execute what Odom wants? Last 2 years in assist rate, Utah State 11th last season, first in the nation 2 years ago. His UMBC team that made the tournament, 49th. The best Ryan Odom teams are elite at moving the ball. And it's going to come down to three guys. The two names you just mentioned. Shulga, Jason Nelson, who had a really weird year where he was looking like he was going to run away with Rookie of the Year at the end of November. And by mid-February, he was basically benched. That was also a garbage Richmond team offensively outside of a few guys. This is going to be a much, much better situation for Jason Nelson to try to produce. But maybe the biggest piece, my X factor for this team, is the one returner. Zeb Jackson, who, according to the great guys over on the Black and Gold Fan Pod covering VCU, Zeb Jackson is going to be this team's point guard. And that is something we saw nothing of from him last year. Offensively, he was kind of just a stand in the corner and hopefully this is the game you don't miss all your threes guy with an occasional offensive rebound. He's one of the best defenders in this conference. I think you look at that elite top crew of Holmes, Trey Clark at Duquesne, Kyle Rose at Fordham. That's your top three. And then Jackson's right in that next tier. Right now, if he plays big minutes, I think I might take him as the best of all of those guys. And if VCU can turn him into a playmaker, make his poor shooting matter a little bit less, and allow them to have their best defensive weapon on the court for as long as possible, this is a team that could be great on both ends in the way that the Mike Rhodes teams really weren't. Because this team, they're the inverse now. They're going to be a great offense the way that all their last 10 teams were great on defense. But this team might have more two-way ability than we're used to.
Yeah, I mean, well, first of all, I don't hate that idea for Zeb Jackson, too, because, I mean, he was solid as a slasher last year. Obviously, a fantastic defender, as just about everybody on the Rams was. But, I mean, 18% three-point shooter. It seemed like VCU tried to use him as a three-point threat much more than they should have.
He is not.
But I also think part of it, too, finding himself in a much different role, playing for a different coach who has had a lot of offensive success, especially the last 2 years. That's kind of the one thing that we lamented about Mike Rhodes. And I remember those murmurs were especially loud when VCU had a couple rough games with Ace Baldwin out in December last year, where he just had trouble developing strong offensive players outside of a select few guys, with Baldwin being one of them. So, I mean, that would be an interesting idea to have Jackson running the point, and just maybe playing in a new system will help him out a lot on that end. And we already know, yeah, defensively, he's going to be great.
Yeah, and with all these questions, the backcourt's probably the bigger certainty for the Rams at this point. And honestly, I feel like we could come up with more questions for VCU than basically any team in this league except for the real bad ones. The difference is that the most likely answer to all of them are all some pretty nice answers. But the biggest one is what happens with all these young guys at forward and at the center position? Because with Bairstow out for a while, they're going to have to throw a lot of dudes into the fire immediately. And it just seems destined the way that this is headed now. The VCU will be decent but not great without him. Their at-large chances will probably die in the non-con. He'll come back. They'll immediately kick it into gear and finish in the top two or three and kill the at-large chances of maybe the one team that comes in like that. And it's just going to be a kick in the gut again from that perspective. But you look at their starting schedule, four games in a row at the Siegel Center, McNeese State, Samford, Radford, Seattle. Doesn't sound too special. Every one of those teams has picked top three in their conference. They have NCAA tournament ambitions in the same way that the Rams do. And then they go down to a really, really strong Orlando tournament where they start off against Iowa State. And I think they got to find a way to go 5-2 in November to have some hope. And without Bairstow, The only proven guy they got at those positions is Kwani Kwani, the grad transfer from Cal. So I'll throw out a whole bunch of names to see who you want to jump on here. We got Fats Billups, Christian Fermin, Toby Lawall coming back for year two. You got Roosevelt Wheeler, the big center transfer from Louisville. And then you got Michael Bell, the incredibly intriguing French freshman who we've barely talked about. He might be the best freshman in this conference immediately. But one of those guys has to step up right off the jump and be a huge difference maker from game one.
Well, I think first of all, it is encouraging that Odom was able to keep Billups, Furman, and Lawall, three freshmen who, outside of Lawall for a little bit late in the season, didn't see a whole lot of run last year. But if there is one thing we can be very confident about Mike Rhodes' tenure at VCU, he recruited some good players. And I would expect at least one of those guys is going to develop into a starter at some point in the next year or two. But there's really just not much proven in terms of the more known quantities. I mean, Kwani Kwani and Roosevelt Wheeler are both playing at the Power Five level, but I don't think you can just ignore that their respective teams won a combined seven games last year. I mean, Cal and Louisville both would have easily been A-10 pillow fight teams. I think with Kwani, he's a grad transfer, has started at Cal for a couple of years. Not sure if he's as much of a true center as what VCU has had in the past couple seasons.
I
He's
don't think
more
they'll
of a,
play him there. I think he's probably
yeah,
too slight.
probably right. I mean, he's been used more of a as a shooter earlier in his career. And then Wheeler at 6'11", I mean, going to be one of the biggest guys in the conference. It's kind of just harder to take away much from his stats, just with Louisville struggles, obviously being in a bad situation. Although I do think it is important to note that 2 years ago he was a top 100 recruit. So if Odom can harness some of that talent, then I mean, VCU could potentially be just fine at the center position.
Yeah, and Kwani Kwani to me just kind of feels like a perfect 1 year help bridge the gap to the young guys role player. Okay shooter for his size, about 30% on his career. Decent rebounder, a good defender. He's just someone who will bring them 20 to 25 steady minutes at that power forward spot. To me, the guy that I'm kind of looking at is Toby Lawall. Freak leaper. We talked about that last year. But was just a really unpolished player when he got on the court last year. Biggest problem being he was just too skinny to deal with the bigger centers in this league. And he got pushed around too easily. And I think that's why he never was able to gain a foothold. Mike Rhodes, every time he would try him, he would feel like he had to yank him pretty soon after. But that guy might be the best athlete on this team, maybe even one of the three or four best athletes in the A-10 conference. So that's a guy that I'm going to look long and hard at in the first like 2 weeks of the season to see, first of all, did he put on more muscle in the offseason? And then did he get more skilled offensively? Because he's someone that could really be a potential breakout guy.
I mean, I think so. Out of guys who played 5 minutes a game last year, he probably had the most highlight reel plays in the conference. So I think he's the easiest returning sophomore to get the most excited about for VCU. But really, every single one of the guys we mentioned, and I would say this is the first team in the entire preview series where we even mentioned all of the scholarship names on the roster. I'm pretty confident they're all going to have to play because with Joe Bamisil not getting a transfer waiver, the Rams are already down to just 10 rotation players going into the season. One of them, Bairstow, is already injured for probably the entire non-conference. Are you concerned at all just that they don't have enough depth starting out the season?
Not really. Like, unless some guys on the team are going to go get thrown out of the university for committing a dormitory crime, like, that's really the only situation where we see teams fall down to seven or eight scholarship players. Although the last time that happened, ended up pretty well for that team. I think VCU would take two NCAA tournament wins and a loss to Oklahoma in the second round if that were to be the case this year. But No, it's not a huge deal. Like, I think the biggest thing is all of these guys appear to be deserving of rotation minutes right now. So it's not like you lose two players and all of a sudden, oh crap, we got to play this bum freshman who is supposed to be a development project. We got to throw him into the fire now. Like, all of these guys are going to be fighting for minutes immediately. So I don't think it's a big deal unless their training staff just turns out to be a disaster this season.
Yeah, hopefully not. And I mean, really, it just kind of gives them a little bit less breathing room if you have another early season injury, especially to one of the more proven guys on the roster. But I mean, I definitely would agree with your sentiment that all 10 of the scholarship guys that are eligible, I mean, I think they're all pretty clearly Atlantic 10 Division I caliber players, and don't think any of them are going to embarrass themselves out there. In terms of expectations, I feel like this is a little bit more of a challenge just because VCU, kind of in a similar vein to Dayton, they always have high expectations and they should. They're one of the best programs in the conference, but this is a unique situation where you're losing a coach coming off an NCAA tournament appearance and pretty much flipping over the entire roster.
I think publicly the VCU fans will say it's the same as Dayton. They expect to go to the NCAA tournament this year. The roster certainly has the talent for it. I agree with that. I think internally, we got a few drinks in these guys. They'd all say they're probably happy with the NIT this year. Just given the overhaul that happens, completely switching regimes. I'm pretty sure this team has to stink for them to end up frustrated with year one of the Ryan Odom era. I think they're just looking for what is essentially kind of a lower level VCU year over the last few seasons. Clear top four team in the title contention race until at least the last like game or two, and make the postseason in some capacity.
Yeah, I mean, I know it's not the normal expectation, but I feel like an NIT would be a pretty solid accomplishment. And I think the bigger picture is going into year two, year three of the Ryan Odom era, that's where you should have the pieces in place for its NCAA tournament. And by the way, remember how much VCU struggled in the first year with Mike Rhodes and then how awesome they were the second year? Like, even if they struggle a little bit, it's such a strong program that I wouldn't worry too much. I think the ceiling is very high, just with the Utah State transfers, the returning guys that we just don't have enough film on right now. They could reach very high highs, but there's also just a ton of question marks in comparison to the other teams that we're talking about tonight.
Yeah, and we need to remember this team's five starters from last year who are all now gone. They lose an all-conference guy to graduation. They lost three starters who are going to all start at the Power Five level this year at Penn State, Baylor, and Florida State. And their worst starter, Nick Kern, is going to at least be a major rotation piece at Penn State. So it is, in a sense, it is a weird rebuilding year. There's just so much more talent on this roster than the other teams we talked about being in a rebuild. And that makes it weird. But I want to wrap it up here. Would it be the most A10 thing ever for them to get epitome of brutality by one of these good teams they play at the beginning of the year? Because all the young guys just come out slow. They finish eighth in Orlando. And then all of a sudden, Sean Bairstow comes back and they win their appeal of Joe Bamisil's waiver. And they just get both of them in mid-December. They go like 16-2, win the conference, and aren't good enough for an at-large because they stunk for like a five-game stretch in November when they were missing two of their three best guys.
I mean, I could buy that happening. We've seen a lot the last couple of years, and that certainly wouldn't help the three bid league brand, I'll tell you that. That sounds like a one bid league to me if all that happens, but no, it wouldn't be that surprising at all.
And let's make one thing very clear. If Bamisil somehow gets a waiver, and we didn't bother talking about him because I think it's really, really, really unlikely at this point. He already got denied. They're trying to appeal. If he does, this is definitely the best offense in the league. So let's make that clear.
Really? Best offensive team. I mean, Bama's still.
I think they're probably top three anyway, but
Yeah.
the dynamite deadeye scorer that he is, a guy who I had second team all conference 2 years ago on a bad GW team.
Yeah.
I feel pretty good about saying that.
Yeah. I mean, that is unfortunate. And hopefully, I don't know how much we should count on it or expect it, but
I'd be stunned if it happens.
yeah, that is a big loss for VCU, just giving them one less proven option of someone that we know can put up a ton of points.
All right. Duquesne Dukes are preseason top four.
But are they for real?
I couldn't do enough research of finding old preseason polls, but I can say with confidence this has not happened since maybe the early 90s at best, but probably the early 80s. They bring back a lot of guys from the team that was picked dead last in the league last year and then had a chance to get a double bye on the last day of the season, including their stud wing combo, the all-conference guard Dede Grant, the all-defensive team perimeter man Trey Clark. Kareem Rozier will likely step in next to them at the point guard position. They bring back their best defensive big man in Trey Williams and a whole bunch of other options there, including David Dixon and an apparently now healthy Khalil Barre.
I think the biggest thing that just jumps out looking at this roster, this team is absolutely massive, and pretty much every newcomer, with the exception of one freshman, Keith Nambrot just went all out recruiting rim protectors, guys that are going to crash the boards inside. On paper, this just seems like one of the most physical teams that we've seen in a while in the A-10.
And by the way, somehow they're going to start a perimeter of 5'9", 6'2", 6'3".
Right.
Yeah, this team actually has too many big guys. Like, I don't understand how they're going to play them all unless somebody just gets hurt. It's going to be mid-January, and a good player is just going to be sitting on the bench pissed all game because he's playing like 4 minutes a night. It's absolutely absurd. This is the deepest team in the A-10. I don't even think it's particularly close. They have this just ridiculous level of optionality, especially in the front court.
Well, I think we can start out maybe because we know there's a lot of true centers, guys that can really only play the five on this team. But I guess one of the questions is just getting into, and you talked about how it could be potentially a very small starting backcourt, but those three guards aren't going to be able to play the entire game. How many of these wings are quick enough and good enough at shooting to play the three? Because really, the three names that jump out to me. Andre Savrasov, an all Sunbelt second team guy at Georgia Southern, shot 36% from three. And honestly, looking at his stats, feel like I overlooked him at least as an incoming transfer. And then two guys that we should all be familiar with, Fusini Drame and Hassan Drame, coming over from LaSalle, both crazy talented offensive rebounders, which was probably the Explorers' greatest strength last year. Not as strong of shooters as Savrasov, but I mean, showed that they can compete in the A-10.
Well, we saw last year there was a Drame playing the small forward position a good amount of the time for LaSalle. So I think that's probably just your go-to answer. I'll be quick with this because these are guys who are going to be lesser on the minutes charts. But this is one of my questions, is how do they take care of the perimeter depth? And it's three guys on the back end of the roster. Two freshman guards, Callan Nichols from Canada, Jakub Nexus, there's no way I'm saying that right, but from the Czech Republic, who, by the way, is a 6'8 wing. No big deal. This team is ginormous. And then joining Matuš Šaranský, another 6'8 wing who showed some unbelievable flashes of like ball handling and passing brilliance in November, and then just got derailed by some illnesses and injuries the rest of the year and basically was out of the rotation by season's end. But someone's going to have to play backup minutes at those guard spots. It's going to have to be one of those guys. And they're all just huge, huge mysteries. They never solved that spot last year. Like, if Kareem Rozier had to play big minutes, all of a sudden they're going to Quincy McGriff. It was a big drop-off when he came in the game. They can't have that happen again this season.
I think part of the big question mark around the guard depth is we're kind of just assuming Kareem Rozier is going to have a much improved season. And he was very solid as a freshman last year, but only played 15 minutes a game, averaged about 4 points and 2 rebounds. I would say compared to other true freshman point guards, didn't make a whole lot of mistakes. Like, there wasn't a big drop off when he got into the game for the Dukes, and he was clearly a leader much beyond his experience. I guess just my question, though, is how much production does Duquesne need from him to reach their goals? Do they just need him to be a steady hand, but doing it at a greater scale and playing 32 minutes a game, or will they need more points and assists?
It depends on where Duquesne thinks they're going to go. He is my biggest X factor in the entire A-10 this year. If he is a league average, or maybe even can slip into above average starting point guard, they will be in a postseason tournament. I say that with full confidence. If Kareem Rozier is awesome this season, worst case, this team's going to the NIT because the rest of the roster is there. He's going to make a huge contribution defensively no matter what. I feel very confident in saying that. He was easily their second best perimeter defender last year behind Clark. Offensively, yeah, it's going to be a lot of just being a ball distributor, but one of the sneaky things about this roster is it's not a great shooting unit outside of Grant and Clark again. They're going to need a high 30s percentage shooting year from deep from Rozier. And that's probably the biggest swing factor for him. I don't think they need him to score a ton, but they definitely need him to be a dangerous floor spacing threat.
I would definitely agree that's important. And I feel like based on the additions, Duquesne should have a little bit more inside scoring than last year, but this was really a team that did a lot of running and gunning, actually led the conference in 3-point point distribution by percentage. They took a ton of threes. A lot of that, I mean, Day-Day Grant, clearly one of the best returning 3-point shooters, but they also had Tevin Brewer at the point guard spot as someone who could space the floor. And that isn't something that Rozier has proven to be able to do just yet. Do you feel like this is going to be a team that still continues to shoot a lot of 3-pointers, or based on the makeup of the roster, do they need to look more inside?
I think just because Clark and Grant are going to be your dominant offensive players, yes. But the biggest thing, and I think one of the biggest reasons why they struggled to score on the interior, because it wasn't for lack of guys who could do it. Austin Rotrov and Joe Reese, two guys who specialize down in the paint. Trey Williams is a really crafty dude when he gets the ball in his hands within 12 feet of the hoop. But that paint got clogged too often because they couldn't keep defenders honest. And they weren't hitting enough of their threes. So they're going to have to space the floor in order to kind of open up the rim.
I was surprised last year, too, just looking at the stats. New Trey Williams was a great defensive player, but only averaged about 6.5 points a game last year. Feel like that would regress to the mean a little bit higher and get close to where he was at 2 years ago. But
he just didn't play an important offensive role last year. Because of that, the centers were clogging up the paint all game, and he kind of didn't have a place to go.
Right. I don't know. I mean, I feel like having so many options at that position, that definitely helps keep the bodies fresh, throwing the defense a ton of different looks. It's just such an interesting team makeup where normally it feels like, especially at the mid-major ranks, you see teams going in with, oh, they've got a ton of guards, like they recruited a ton of 6'2 guys, but don't have a lot of size. This is kind of the complete opposite, where we're just not sure how many guys can actually handle the ball on this team outside of the three guards coming back.
I do want to take a quick moment here to talk about a guy that we really haven't covered much through the offseason anyway, and is someone who I think, like you said, is slipping under the radar, probably because he's blocked by Trey Williams, and I just don't really see a path to him starting. But Andre Savrestov was an all-conference guy in a Sun Belt that was really not that much worse than the A-10 last year.
No, I actually noticed, yeah, the A-10 was 13th in KenPom. The Sun Belt was one spot below. And I mean, he's second team. Like, that's basically what Day-Day Grant was coming from the MAC, an all-conference guy in a comparable conference.
Elite rebounder, a guy who has a real post-up game with actual skills. I'll have to go find the great account CBB Europe put up his highlights months ago when he went in the portal. The dude can post up. He's got skill down there. But he can space the floor too at 39% from deep. That's the big guy who might give you some floor spacing and let you get away with things like playing one of the Drames at the three. But he's someone that just really is not getting talked about at all. And I feel like he's going to sneak up on really everyone outside of the Duquesne circles when they realize that he might be the best bench player in the league this year.
Yeah, I mean, I would say we've already talked about how important Rozier is, but I think out of the newcomers, Savrasov has to be the most important because he is really the one big on the team that is proven to be able to space the floor. And I just think Duquesne is going to need him to spend some time at the three next year. I would be surprised if they didn't shoot a ton of three-pointers like they did last year, and that's one of the big strengths of his game, and will open up a lot of the inside if he is able to continue shooting around 40%.
Yeah, and I couldn't get it pulled up quick enough, but ninth in the Sun Belt in rebounding last year. Four spots behind old friend Makai Long, who's at Old Dominion now, or was at least last year. My last thing, my biggest question about this team, how do you fit the pieces together from a lineup perspective just throughout the game? I think that Keith Dambrot has probably more of an ability to affect wins and losses than any other coach in the A-10 this season. Because you look at all this talent on paper, and we've just run down guy by guy. There's a ton of good defenders on this team, but there's a lot of overlapping skill sets. Trey Williams is going to play the four for this team. He was without a doubt their best defensive center last year. And I think that that's probably going to continue to be true this year. But meanwhile, you got other guys like Dusan Mihorcic, Khalil Barre, who are just human brick walls. Like, to play those guys together means to play Williams out of his best spot. In the backcourt, Kareem Rozier is just, he's an effing bulldog. He is a guy who will hound and harass your point guard to the moment that he absolutely loses his mind. But at the same time, Trey Clark's best skill is harassing your point guards and shutting down their passing lanes. And even offensively, like we talk about, there's just not a ton of floor spacers here. There's a lot of talent on paper. There's also a lot of lineup combos that, when you really start to run through them, just don't really make sense. And so they're going to have to figure out who fits with who. Where do you get the magic of like Trey Williams and David Dixon? Where Dixon can chase quicker forwards on defense and let Williams guard to protect the rim. On offense, Dixon gives you a little bit of spacing and that it allows Williams to be creative around the rim. They got to find combos like that. And especially as I start to look at like the three spot, like playing the Drames there, it's fine. LaSalle did it last year. They can guard perimeter guys, but when we talk about like the Dayton guards or Moses Flowers and Charles Pride or Cam Brown over at St. Joe's, you're going to need to figure out how to handle that spot defensively with some of your backup guys on the perimeter. So this, whoever's running lineups for Duquesne this year has a chance to secretly be the coach of the year if they're a good team, but it's also where the Dukes could just completely self-combust.
It's going to be interesting to figure out what they decide on for rotations. I think part of it too, just with the newcomers and a lot of the guys coming back, a lot of individually talented defenders, but just seeing how that's going to fit together. In particular, I'm just interested in the front court because really that was a couple areas, despite having Trey Williams, where the Dukes shot themselves in the foot last year. 14th in the conference in defensive rebounding rate. They just gave up a ton of second chance points. And I think part of that had to do with having a small backcourt, but also only 10th in the conference in block rate. And Williams isn't really as much of a rim protector as some of the other guys. I mean, he's only 6'6", 6'7". So think you would see more of that from the guys like Dixon, Bure, Mihorcic. Feel like we would expect that to go up this year just with Duquesne's sheer size, but yeah, it's just kind of a complete mystery at this point in the offseason how these lineups are going to look together. Certainly seems like there's a ton of options, but they could go a lot of different ways.
Yeah, this is going to be, at least to me, I think they're probably the most interesting team this year in terms of all the different places they can go and all the talent on the roster. But expectations, I'll start this one off. This team has to make the postseason. The best thing they've done since 1977 is being the last team to make the NIT in 2009 and then losing in double overtime in a first round game at Virginia Tech. Like, this has to be better. And you look at the history of the Duquesne teams that have had this level of expectation going into the year. 2011, they start off conference play 8-0 and then collapse down the stretch. They bring back their three best guys from that team, including rookie of the year TJ McConnell, and then proceed to go 16-15. McConnell leaves, Ron Everhart gets fired. We can even go back to the fact that coming off that NIT run, they lost their best player in Aaron Jackson, but brought back every other member of their rotation, 16-16. 2020, they had a chance to get a double bye going into the last night before Jacob Gilyard just took Sincere Carey's lunch money over and over and scarred him so bad that he had to leave the A-10. But once again, they bring back basically the same roster. Granted, it was the COVID season. They lost two starters to transferring midseason, but 9-9. Like, the point is, at some point, Duquesne, in the rare year where they actually have expectations, has to produce. This team hasn't been in the NCAA tournament in. I have to redo the math every time because it just seems so ridiculous every time I think it. If they make it this year, it will have broken a 47-year drought. 1977, the original A-10, so new it was called the Eastern Eight, the last time the Dukes went to an NCAA tournament. I don't think that has to be the expectation, but this team has to make the NIT. If they lose all these guys from what is now a really old roster, the fan base might just not show up the year after.
Yeah, I mean, I think we can say a lot about how much Keith Stambrot has done to resurrect the program. I mean, the Dukes were, they've been in a bad place for many years, but especially coming out of Jim Ferry's tenure. I guess the one thing you can really gripe about Stambrot, though, he just hasn't put together two very good seasons in a row yet. And last year was a huge improvement, jumping from 15th to 6th place. They just need to get over the hump this year. And obviously, NCAA tournament is the dream. That's what everyone wants. But I feel like going to an NIT, for all the reasons you mentioned, that would be a huge step in the right direction. And also doesn't feel like, just with how many transfers he's accumulated over the years, it doesn't feel like they would go away after next year either. That would just continue to build a lot of momentum and they'd still keep some of the young guys around and just continue to rebuild.
Yeah, it's going to dictate how these next few years go. If this is a good team, it's Rozier and Dixon and Barre and all those young perimeter backups I just talked about. And yeah, they probably do just reload with transfers. If they underwhelm this year, Dambrot's been around a long time. You wonder, even if he didn't get fired, maybe he retires. Like, this could look completely different this year, depending on what happens this season. And I want to wrap it up here. If David Dixon starts at the five, which I do not think is going to happen, at this point, I'd probably guess Barre, given that Mahorčić is out for most of November, it seems. Or maybe they go a little smaller and start Savrastov. But if they started David Dixon, their entire eight-man bench unit would be international players. They only have five Americans under scholarship, and it's their four surefire starters and David Dixon.
Wow. That isn't, I didn't put that together, but that is a, yeah, that's right.
I think it's three, off the top of my head, I think it's four Eastern Europeans, all from different countries, three players from Africa, and a Canadian.
All right. Is it the best for last, or is it just the last?
It's just the last. I'll wait till the hot takes pod, though.
Okay.
All right. Our 15th and final team preview, the St. Bonaventure Bonnies, who, after returning only one player who played minutes last season, the least amount of returning minutes in recorded college basketball history, that guy then went on to play 9 minutes in one game and then leave the school. Now they bring back basically everybody. Their whole starting lineup from the end of the year, Kyra Luke, Daryl Banks, Moses Flowers, Jan Farrell, and Chad Venning. They bring back their sixth man, Barry Evans. And then they reload with some interesting transfers. So it's a lot of the same for St. Bonaventure. They got to find a way to either have some internal improvement or some improvement from those transfers to jump from eighth place where they finished last year into this potential title race that it looks like they might be in the thick of.
Yeah, and that's certainly where they're getting picked. I feel like in general, and maybe it's because of what you mentioned, St. Bonaventure finishing eighth place, I feel like between that and when they beat VCU and Dayton in back-to-back weekends, I don't know. It felt like the general vibe was that St. Bonaventure didn't have that rough of a season. They finished 201st in KenPom, which was the worst for Mark Schmidt since his first year as a head coach at St. Bonaventure, which is kind of, I mean, I think one, that's a huge testament to the level of consistency that he's had, but also just shows that last year was definitely a transition period where they had to replace an entire roster.
Yeah, and now we look at the fact that he went out and really found a pair of guys who probably best address the two biggest holes from last year's roster. Micah Adams-Woods, who people are saying is going to come off the bench. I'm high on this guy. He wasn't necessarily the point guard at Cincinnati, but was a great secondary playmaker, much in the same way that Max Scholga was at Utah State. Still over three assists a game back-to-back seasons. Shot 36.5% from three. I think he's just St. Bonaventure's go-to point guard this year. I would not be surprised if he overtakes Kyra Luke, given Luke's struggles in the second half of the season.
I mean, I think part of what people might be sleeping on with Adams Woods not putting up eye-popping stats at Cincinnati, he still started there, played 30 minutes a game, and you would think someone who could start on a borderline NIT team would have a clear path to playing time. I think part of it just has to do with the addition of him, Charles Pride, and the return of all of the other key guards from last year's team. There's just a lot of different options. And if there's one thing we can expect, I feel like we won't see Daryl Banks be top five in the nation in minutes rate again this year. Feels
this
like
this isn't Mark Schmidt team. I would not assume that at all.
I mean, probably not, but at least they have the personnel where if they want to give him more of a break and
he might
share the
level
a little bit more. Yeah.
Instead of third.
Exactly. Give him 2.5 minutes a game on the bench.
But yeah, Adams Woods is my X factor. I think he's going to go a long way in dictating whether this is just a good team versus a great team. if he's a potential all-conference player, then yeah, they probably should be in the title race. But for me, where I'm looking for the leap, where I'm looking for the reason that this team could be an NCAA tournament squad, and my biggest question, does either Yann Farrell or Chad Venning take a big step up? Because to me, the reason why they stabilized in conference play, why they were able to get those double wins in the city of Richmond, and the fact that they were clearly a better team in the second half of the year than in the non-con, was because those two guys made significant in-season improvements. And this is the Mark Schmidt specialty. Yann Farrell is on a track that we've seen with Mark Schmidt players so many times. And I guess you can probably throw Chad Venning into the same group because he played his freshman year off at a team in a bad conference and basically didn't play. But you see freshmen take big leaps under Schmidt in their first year with him. And then they come back after that first full summer with the team. And his best players take a leap again. So, do one of those two have that in them? Are they ready to join Darryl Banks as a star on this team and help him shoulder the load? I think this team probably needs a little bit more dynamism on the offensive end that really only those two can provide in the paint. They were a bad two-point shooting team last year.
They were just a bad offensive team in general last year, and I agree with you that they're gonna need to get more out of those two players. I think with Farrell, just in general, I mean, you have to classify his freshman season as a big success. Really, really good rebounding numbers. I think he was a way better three-point shooter than anyone could have expected, but that was about the extent of his offensive game, just as a three-point shooter. Not much of a slasher yet, someone that was strong enough to finish at the rim enough. And I feel like that's going to be necessary. Venning was really the only true inside threat the Bonnies had. And I kind of feel like he was a year ahead of schedule to what we would have expected. Coming off a pretty underwhelming tenure at Morgan State, he ended up
Didn't
putting
even
up
start
some.
the first game for the Bonnies.
Yeah, I mean, I think even the first couple games of last year, we just assumed he'd be a role player and depth on the team. And he ended up being one of the most important pieces there. So seeing if there is another gear for him next year. Apparently Schmidt has said that he's completely transformed his body over the offseason, the stereotypical best shape of his life guy for the A-10 this year. But I mean, just experiencing his breakout last year, and especially on the offensive end, wouldn't be that surprising to see if he can continue to improve there.
Yeah, and kind of going off of that, my second question for them was, who does give them offensive production inside the arc? They really only had two guys who were above average shooters from two. Obviously, Venning was just a wrecking ball down there, 58% from two. And then Moses Flowers, who was surprisingly more efficient than I think most people would realize. But that production is going to have to come from either Venning going from really good to just flat out spectacular in that regard. It could come from Yann Farrell developing more of a slashing game, but more likely it's going to come from Charles Pride, the transfer from Bryant, 50% shooter from inside the arc for the duration of his career. Also a guy who spaces the floor. He is a dude that can just get you buckets all over the court. But his year-by-year stats are some of the wildest to ever look at. His sophomore season, the weird kind of COVID disrupted year, 14 points a game, 7 rebounds. He shoots 41% from three and 50% from the field. The next year, he starts taking a ton of shots. His efficiency numbers drop mightily. He's under 33% from deep, but yet he's still scoring 17.7 a game, putting up about 8.5 rebounds, just tremendous for a 6'4 guard. Last year, his role lessens a little bit. The shooting numbers came back a little bit, but weren't as great as they were in his sophomore campaign. But he saw his shooting, and weirdly, even though he was playing the same amount of minutes, his rebounding dropped off a lot last year. And this guy is just kind of an enigma. Now coming up from what was the worst conference in college basketball last year. And I'm really interested to see what he does in an offense playing for a coach who lives and breathes basketball as opposed to one who's trying to figure out how to pin crimes on his wife. Also, for anyone who doesn't know, look up Jared Grasso body cam video and then research who Jared Grasso is. It is a delightful 20 minutes.
Yeah, I was about to cue up my take on the Jared Grasso situation, but you beat me to it.
It's just so funny. That's my take.
That's unbelievable. No, I think pride is probably the X factor on the team for me this year. And you mentioned the crazy swings in his stats from year to year, but over 4 years at Bryant, he put up a ton of points and rebounds. Really interesting game, just as a 6'4 guard, even though he can shoot it. Very good at getting to the rim. He was around 60% there last year. And the one key that stayed consistent from each of his last 2 years, and something that the Bonnies desperately need as one of the weakest offensive teams in the conference, 2022, he led the NEC in offensive rating and conference play. And then last year, as Bryant moved to the American East Conference, he was third. So very efficient player. Overall, St. Bonaventure was just a poor shooting team, really, from all areas of the court, turned the ball over too much. I think Pride's just general efficiency is going to do a lot for this team. And I don't know if they're even going to need him to have tremendously, tremendously high usage ratings. Maybe it will be similar to what we saw last year, where he was just one of many role guys for Bryant. But with the sheer depth of this backcourt, I think we'll still see Banks lead the way most nights, but I don't think any one guy is going to have to carry the team and consistently be that go-to guy for it to work.
First off, if you hadn't said it right now, I would have made it to like mid-January before I remembered that Bryant was in the America East.
Yeah, they just switched last year.
I definitely thought they were still in the NEC last season. But the timer just coming right in the middle of me switching thoughts and really killed my train of thought. But yeah, he has to be a big time secondary scorer for this team. They needed one desperately last year. That's why Moses Flowers moved into the starting lineup. He gave them a little bit of that heat check ability. But Daryl Banks, as we've talked about earlier in this offseason, he's the king of boom or bust from a scoring perspective. He is a guy who can look like an All-American for 3-4 straight games and then put up single-digit scoring numbers for 3 in a row. And when he had bad games, St. Bonaventure's offense was a true abomination. And that's where Charles Pride comes in. Him and Flowers, along with the point guards, are going to have to find ways to carry them on the nights where Daryl Banks doesn't have it.
So I think it's fair to say that expectations are higher than they were last season for St. Bonaventure, but what should the goals for this program be? I think overall, maybe a little bit lower than Duquesne, just because the Bonnies have much more recent success going to the NCAA tournament in 2021. I still feel like an NIT, though, or at least being very close to the postseason at the end of the year wouldn't be a bad season, with, I think, the hope of bringing back most of these guys next year and having a true run at an NCAA appearance.
I think it's the same. I think it's any level of postseason, because you got to remember Banks, Pride, Adams, Woods, and Flowers are all gone at the end of this year. So yeah. You bring back that fun front court with Farrell and Venning. You bring back Kyrell Luke. But then other than that, it's Barry Evans and the freshman Dwayne Thompson, who we wouldn't really talk about. He was highly touted, but I don't see a clear path to minutes for him on this team. They're going to have to completely rebuild the perimeter next year. And given the high ceiling of this team, I think it's going to be a disappointing year if all of a sudden they finish sixth and turn down a CBI invite.
This might need to be didn't Duquesne go to the CBI last year?
Oh, they did. And they blew a massive lead to Rice in the second half, because Duquesne is horrible in postseason games.
That's definitely going to be an over-under for our Hot Takes episode. Over-under 0.5 CBI appearances for the A-10.
already got a good one related to something that happened in this episode. Well, that's why I'm not doing an error segment. For anyone who knows I made a screw up earlier, I'm not going to bring it back up because I'll mention it on Hot Takes.
All right. Well, we have made it through the sixth, I think it's sixth, preseason team preview series. Yeah, we're basically
grateful at this point.
Pretty much. Any other thoughts before we wrap this up and get even closer to the start of the season?
Yeah, I have a stat of the day just because I wanted to mention it earlier, and it's just too good for me to let it go unheard. So one of the most interesting things about VCU, we talk about the change in identity. KenPom actually projects them as a better defensive team than offensive this year, but still taking a step down on that end. He has them 67th in the country right now. If that's where they end up, that would be the 11th best VCU defense of the last 12 years. The only exception is that bad team that Mike Rhodes got stuck with his first year. They were 156. Like, it would actually be a massive step down for VCU defensively to be 67th in the country, which probably translates to like third in the A-10.
I mean, I'm sure for a lot of coaches in the A-10, 67th would be the best season of their career on defense. So that is pretty crazy to think about.
And by the way, if you do the math, this is how long it's been since the Final Four run. That time period starts the year after. They were 78th with the Final Four team. Hmm. When you include, when you run through from Capel to Grant to Shaka to Wade to Rhodes, of all of the good teams they had over those years, so discluding like the two or three rough seasons they had, of every good team VCU has had in this century, the worst defensive team they had was the Final Four squad.
I mean, you want to talk about
a large margin.
Yeah. You want to talk about the most Atlantic 10 thing ever, though. Watch VCU just be like 12th in the country in defense and lead the nation in steals. And just like out of nowhere, Ryan Odom's just going to throw out everything from the last couple of years,
so,
and just bring back
havoc.
This is
the Zeb Jackson plays 36 minutes a game scenario.
Probably. I mean, I don't even know what to expect for that team, but I'm not.
And Toby LaWall just turns into Hassan Ward reincarnate.
Well, that would be fun. I mean, I hope that one happens.
Man, I hope the VCU fans stuck around for those hot comments.
I do too. I hope you all stuck around for the entire episode, but I mean, we put timestamps on everything. So if you don't want to listen through all of this banter, you know, go back for any of the last few weeks of episodes, check out just the teams that you want to hear us talk about. And like we said at the beginning, let us know your thoughts. Let us know what we might've gotten wrong or who you think is in line to have a big season for your team. But this is always fun too. I can't wait, especially once the games start getting played. It's fun to just see that random freshman that plays 28 minutes on opening night. And it's like, oh, I didn't really know he was even on the team. And it just catches you by surprise. I'm sure we're going to have a ton of those again this year.
Yeah, we'll see what happens. And be sure to go back if you're fiending for content at this point. We had a bunch of great offseason episodes with great guests. So go back and listen to those. We got a week and change left until the season starts. We'll have a new episode next week, and then we'll have our hot takes coming out on the morning of opening day. Knowing who our guest is coming up next and knowing that we have hot takes going, I gotta say, our next two episodes will probably be two of our best of the whole year. So everyone be sure to tune in for those. Matt, any closing thoughts on the team preview series? I'm personally just glad we finally figured out after year one to not do seven in one episode.
Yeah, we have come a long way since then. That one we also still record in like an hour, though. And now we're doing four teams in an hour and a half.
Yeah, well, because in all honesty, we kind of just didn't know like eight of the teams in the league that year.
No, it was rough. No, I guess the one closing thought going into the team previews before I had done much research at all, I was very down on the A-10. I thought it might be even worse than last year. I could see things getting better. I think, I mean, there's a lot of teams that could be very terrible, but Just with how many question marks, if enough things break the right way, there's at least going to be some very fun teams in the league this year, and potentially the opportunity to see some new faces at the top that we haven't seen in a while, contending for championships.
Yeah, it's better. I don't know how much better, but it's better. It's also better than that first year, the 2019 that you referenced earlier. Like this is not a true basement year for the conference. Hopefully they can get the at-large train rolling again and make that very clear. But I just want to close out on this, how far we've come. Like we did not know what we were talking about for a bunch of teams in those previews, but a name that kept flashing across my research today. Man, I was right on Taylor Funk. My breakout player, my X factor for a St. Joe's team that I picked to win the league that year. Instead, they were bad and Phil Martelli got fired. But
Yeah.
it may have taken all the way to getting to Utah State under Ryan Odom. But last year, Taylor Funk finally became the star I always believed he could be.
It's 4 years too early.
In a year that at that point we didn't even think that Taylor Funk would be able to play basketball in.
Wow.
Because he got a COVID year and he redshirted in between. So he was supposed to be gone 2 years before that.
Well, better late than never. Congrats on the late victory lap.
Yeah, thank you, Taylor Funk. And thank you all for listening to another off-season episode of the 3-Bid League podcast. We already gave you the spiel. Bunch of good episodes. Go back and listen to them. Follow us on Twitter at the number 3-Bid League Pod. Follow us on Blue Sky, number 3-Bid League Pod over there as well. If you got any comments, if you like the show, please give us 5 stars on iTunes and keep tuning in these last few weeks. Opening day just around the corner. We're going to have plenty more great stuff coming to you.